And the way you see the defense is that you'll, in effect, put him on trial. You'll slander his good name by exposing all of his sins and bad habits. It's not slander if it's true. That could be a very nasty trial, Jake. I'm sorry I mentioned it, Harry Rex. I don't plan on being anywhere near that courtroom. Now you're lying. No, I think about trials because I'm a lawyer, but this one is for someone else. I'll get through the preliminary stuff, then unload the kid. I doubt that. I truly doubt that, Jake. I just hope you're not screwing up Smallwood. Truthfully, I really don't give a damn what happens to Stuart Kofer or his girlfriends and kids and people I've never met, but I do care about Smallwood. That case could be the biggest payday in our lousy little careers. I don't know. I got $1,000 for the Haley case, and that's about all you'll get for this turkey, too. Well, at least we have Noose on our side. For now, I don't trust him as much as you do. Have you ever met a judge you trusted? No, nor a lawyer. Look, I gotta go. I need a favor. A favor? Right now, I'd like to choke you. Yeah, but you won't. Tomorrow morning at 6, I'll walk into the coffee shop and say hello to Marshall Prather. Same routine. Might be another deputy or two at the table. I need a wingman.
You've lost your mind, Jake.
Come on, pal. Think of all the crazy stuff I've done for you.
Nope. You're on your own.
Tomorrow morning, you get another dose of life as a small-town criminal lawyer. And you're afraid to be seen with me.
No, I'm afraid of waking up that early.
Beat it, pal. You're making your own decisions these days without regard to others.
I'm pissed, and I plan to stay that way for a long time.
I've heard that before.
This time I mean it. You want to play radical lawyer? Get your buddy Lucian to join you for breakfast. See how the locals enjoy him.
He can't get up that early.
And we know why.
With Hannah tucked in for the night and Jake out roaming the streets, Carla watched television and waited on the 10 o'clock news. She started with the Tupelo station, where, as expected, the murder of Stuart Kofer was the lead story, with a large color image of the deputy in his nicely starched uniform posted as background. Details were still under wraps. A suspect, a minor, name not given, was in custody. There was footage of an ambulance leaving Kofer's property with, presumably, a dead body inside, but none visible. No comment from the sheriff or anyone else with authority. No comments anywhere, yet the intrepid reporter on the scene managed to ramble on about the killing for a solid 5 minutes, while saying almost nothing. Filler was added with live shots of the Ford County courthouse and even the jail, where some patrol cars were filmed coming and going. Carla switched to a Memphis station and learned even less. Though for good measure, the story included something vague about a domestic disturbance, with the mild implication that Kofer had been called to the scene to break up a fight and somehow got hit in the crossfire. There was no reporter on the scene to get to the bottom of things. Evidently, a weekend intern at a news desk was ad-libbing. Another Memphis station spent half its time recapping the city's own daily carnage of home invasions, gang wars, and random murders. It then went south to the Kofer story and the real news that, allegedly, he was the first county officer to be killed in the line of duty since a moonshiner shot two deputies in 1922. Not surprisingly, the reporter spun things to give the impression that the county was still rife with illegal whiskey, drugs, and other lawlessness, a far cry from the safe streets of Memphis. Jake walked in during the last report, and Carla turned off the television and briefed him on the others. He wanted some decaf coffee. She brewed a pot, and they had a cup at the breakfast table where the long day had begun. He replayed his conversations with Ozzie, Drew, and Harry Rex, and he confessed that he was not looking forward to the coming week. She was sympathetic, but obviously worried. She wanted the case to simply go away. Chapter 7. After the Sunday night service at Good Shepherd, Reverend McGarry convened a special meeting of the Board of Deacons. 7 of the 12 were present, 4 women and 3 men, and they gathered in the fellowship hall with cookies and coffee. Kara was next door in the small church parsonage with Meg McGarry, the pastor's wife, eating a sandwich for dinner. The young preacher explained that since Kara had no other place to go at the moment, she would be staying with them until... until what? Until a relative showed up to claim her, which didn't appear likely? Until some court somewhere issued an order? Until her mother was discharged and could leave town with her? Regardless, Carol was now an unofficial ward of the church, and she was traumatized and needed professional help. Throughout the afternoon, she had talked of nothing but her mother and brother and her desire to be with them. Meg had called the hospital and talked to an administrator who said that, yes, they could provide a fold-away bed for the girl to stay with her mother. 2 of the lady deacons volunteered to spend the night down the hall in the waiting room. There was a discussion about food, clothing, and school. Charles was of the firm opinion that Kara should not return to classes for at least a few days. She was far too fragile, and there was the near certainty that another student would say something hurtful. It was finally agreed that the school attendance issue would be dealt with on a day-to-day basis. One member of the church taught algebra at the middle school and would talk to the principal. Another member had a cousin who was a child psychologist, and she would inquire about counseling. Plans were formulated, and at 10 o'clock they drove Kara to the hospital, where the staff had arranged a bed next to her mother's. Josie's vitals were normal, and she said she felt okay. Her swollen and bandaged face, though, told another story. A hospital gown was provided for Kara, and when the nurses turned down the lights, she was sitting at her mother's feet. At 5:30 a.m., Jake's alarm clock started making noises. He silenced it with a slap and rolled back under the covers. So far, he had slept little and was not ready to begin his day. He burrowed deep, found Carla's warm body, moved closer, but was met with resistance. He withdrew, opened his eyes, and thought about his newest client sitting in jail, and was about to surrender to the morning when thunder rolled in the distance. A cold front was expected, with potential storms, and perhaps it wasn't safe to venture out. Another reason to sleep more was the desire to avoid the coffee shop on this dark day, when all the chatter and gossip would be about poor Stu Kofer and the teenage thug who murdered him. Yet another reason was the fact that he was not due in court or anywhere else the entire day. As the reasons accumulated, he felt them closing in, smothering him, and eventually he drifted off. Carla wakened him with a pleasant kiss on the cheek and a cup of coffee. Then she was off to rouse Hannah and get her ready for school. After 2 sips, Jake thought about the newspapers and hopped out of bed. He pulled on some jeans, found the dog, leashed him, and went outside. The morning editions from Tupelo, Jackson, and Memphis were strewn along his drive, and he quickly scanned each. All had the Kofer story on the front page. He tucked them under his arm, made the block, and returned to the kitchen, where he poured more coffee and spread out the papers. The gags were holding. No one was talking. Ozzie wouldn't even confirm that he was the sheriff. Reporters had been shooed away from the crime scene, the jail, the home of Earl and Janet Kofer, and the hospital. Officer Kofer was 33, an Army veteran, single with no children, 4 years as a deputy. The sparse details of his bio were spread thin. The Memphis paper covered the story of Kofer's deadly run-in with some drug dealers 3 years earlier on a rural road near Caraway, a shootout that left the bad guys dead and Lieutenant Kofer only slightly wounded. A bullet grazed his arm, and he refused hospitalization and never missed a day of work. Jake was suddenly in a hurry. He showered, skipped breakfast, kissed his girls goodbye, and headed to the office. He needed to visit the hospital, and it was imperative that he see Drew again. He was convinced the kid was traumatized and needed help, medical as well as legal, but he wanted to pick the right moment for another attorney-client consultation. Evidently, others felt differently. Portia was at her desk, standing, holding the receiver of her phone, looking puzzled. Her customary smile was missing as Jake walked into the office.
"This man just yelled at me," she said.
"Who was it?" She put the receiver away, picked up the Tupelo paper, pointed to the black and white photo of Stuart Kofer, and said,
"Said he was his father. Said his boy got shot yesterday. Shot dead. And that you're the lawyer for the kid who shot him. Talk to me, Jake."
Jake tossed his briefcase onto a chair. "Earl Kofer?"
"That's him. Sounded crazy. Said the kid, Drew somebody, didn't deserve no lawyer. Crazy stuff like that. What's the deal?"
"Have a seat. Is there any coffee?"
"It's brewing."
"Noose appointed me to the case yesterday. I met with the kid last night at the jail. So, yes, our little law firm now represents a 16-year-old boy who will probably be indicted for capital murder."
"What about the public defender?"
"He couldn't defend a bully in kindergarten, and everybody, especially Noose, knows it. He called around and couldn't find anyone else, and he thinks I know what I'm doing."
Portia sat down, tossed the newspaper aside, and said,
"I like it. This will really liven up the place. Almost 9 o'clock on a Monday morning, and we've already had our first nasty phone call."
"There will probably be others."
"Does Lucian know?"
"I haven't told him. And Noose is promising that he'll replace me in 30 days. Just wants me to handle the preliminary stuff."
"Did the boy shoot him?"
"He didn't talk much. In fact, he clammed up and went into a daze. I think he needs some help. Based on what Ozzy said, he shot him once in the head with his own gun."
Did you know Kofer?"
"I know all the cops, some better than others. Kofer seemed to be a good guy, a friendly sort. Last month he spoke to Carla's sixth graders about drugs, and she said he was wonderful."
"Not a bad-looking boy for a white guy."
"I'm going to the hospital in about an hour to see the kid's mother. Looks like Kofer may have knocked her around some before his big moment. You want to go?"
Portia finally smiled and said,
"Of course. I'll get you some coffee."
"What a good little secretary you are."
"I'm a paralegal / research assistant, soon to be law student, and before you know it, I'll be a full-blown partner around here, and you'll be fetching me coffee. One milk, two sugars."
"I'll write that down." Jake climbed the stairs to his office and took off his jacket. He had just settled into his leather swivel when Lucian arrived before the coffee.
"Heard you got a new case," he said with a smile, as he fell into a chair, one that he still owned, because he owned all the other furniture as well as the building itself.
Jake's office, the grandest one, had belonged to Lucian before he was disbarred in 1979, and to his father before he was killed in a plane crash in 1965, and to his grandfather, who built the Wilbanks firm into a powerhouse until Lucian took over and ran off all the paying clients. Jake should have been surprised that Lucian knew, but he wasn't. Like Harry Rex, Lucian seemed to hear the hottest news first, though both had entirely different sources.
"Noose appointed me," Jake said. "I didn't want the case. Still don't." "And why not? I need some coffee."
Usually on a Monday morning, Lucian did not bother with pushing himself out of bed, showering and shaving, and putting on semi-respectable clothes. Since he couldn't practice law, his Mondays were normally spent on the porch trying to drink off the weekend's hangover. The fact that he was awake and fairly presentable meant he wanted details.
"It's coming," Jake said.
"Who told you?"
A worthless question that was never answered.
"Sources, Jake, sources. And why don't you want the case?"
"Harry Rex is afraid it might somehow damage the Smallwood settlement."
"What settlement?"
He thinks they're getting ready to put money on the table. He also thinks that this killing could damage my stellar reputation as a noted trial lawyer. He thinks the public will turn on me and we won't be able to pick fair and open-minded jurors.
When did Harry Rex become an expert on juries?
He thinks he's an expert on people.
I wouldn't let him in front of my jury.
That's my job. I have the charisma.
And the ego. And right now, your ego is telling you that you're far more popular than you really are. Defending this kid will not affect your railroad case.
I'm not sure. Harry Rex thinks otherwise.
Harry Rex can be stupid.
He's a brilliant lawyer who happens to be my co-counsel in what just might be the biggest case of our struggling careers. You don't agree with him?
I seldom do. Sure, you'll take some heat for defending an unpopular client, but what the hell? Most of my clients were unpopular, but that didn't mean they were bad people. I didn't care what these yokels thought about me or them. I had a job to do, and it was completely unrelated to the gossip in the coffee shops and churches. They may talk about you behind your back, but when they get in trouble, they'll want a lawyer who knows how to fight, and fight dirty if necessary. When's the kid going to court?
I have no idea, Lucian. I plan to talk to the DA and to Judge Noose this morning. There's also the matter of youth court.
Not a youth court matter. Not in this backward state.
I know the law, Lucian.
A charge of murder is automatically excluded from youth court jurisdiction.
I know the law, Lucian. Portia opened the door and eased in with coffee and cups on a tray. Lucian continued his lecture.
It really doesn't matter how young the kid is, either. 20 years ago, they put a 13-year-old on trial for murder down in Polk County. I knew his defense lawyer.
Good morning, Lucian,
Portia said politely as she poured coffee.
Morning,
he said without looking at her. In the early days of her employment, he enjoyed long, leering stares. He had touched her a few times, on the arms and shoulders, just little affectionate pats that meant nothing. But after some stern warnings from Jake and a direct threat of bodily harm from Portia, he had backed off and grown to admire her.
We had another call, Jake, about 5 minutes ago, she said. Anonymous. Some hick said if you tried to get this boy off like you got that Haley nigger off, there would be hell to pay.
I'm sorry he said that, Portia, Jake said, stunned.
It's okay. I've heard it before, and I'm sure I'll hear it again.
I'm sorry, too, Portia,
Lucian said softly.
Real sorry.
Jake waved at a wooden chair next to Lucian, and she sat down. In unison, they sipped their coffee and thought about the N-word. 12 years earlier, when Jake finished law school and arrived in Clanton as the rookie, the word was commonly used by white lawyers and judges as they gossiped and told jokes and even did their business without an audience. Now, though, in 1990, its usage was fading and it was deemed improper, even low class, to use it. Jake's mother hated the word and had never allowed it, but growing up in Caraway, Jake knew that his home was different in that respect. He looked at Portia, who at the moment seemed less bothered than the two men, and said, I'm really sorry you heard that in this office.
Hey, I'm okay. I've heard it my entire life. I heard it in the army. I'll hear it again. I can deal with it, Jake. But just to clear the air here, all the players involved are white, right?
Yes.
So we shouldn't expect the cluckers and those guys to show up like Haley, right?
Who knows? Lucian said. There are plenty of nuts out there.
You got that right. Not yet 9 on a Monday morning, and 2 calls are ready. 2 threats.
What was the first one?
Lucian asked. The father of the deceased, a man named Earl Cofer, Jake said. I've never met him, but it looks like that might change.
The father of the deceased called the lawyer of the person arrested for the killing?
Jake and Portia nodded. Lucian shook his head. Then he smiled and said,
I love it. Makes me wish I was back in the trenches.
The desk phone rang, and Jake stared at it. Line 3 was blinking, and that usually meant Carla was calling. He slowly lifted the receiver, said hello, and listened.
She was at school in her classroom, first period. The secretary in the principal's office down the hall had just answered the phone, and a man who refused to give his name asked if Jake Braganza's wife worked there. He said he was a good friend of Stuart Kofor, said Kofor had a lot of friends and that they were upset because Carl Lee Haley's lawyer was now trying to get that kid out of jail, said jail was the only thing keeping the boy alive at the moment. When she asked his name for the second time, he hung up. The secretary informed the principal, who told Carla, then called the city police. When Jake wheeled to a stop in front of the school, he parked behind two patrol cars. An officer named Step Lemon, a former bankruptcy client of Jake's, was at the front door and greeted Jake like an old friend. Lemon said, "The call came from a payphone at Parker Stowe down by the lake. That's as far as we can dig. I'll get Ozzy to ask around at the Stowe, but my guess is it's a waste of time." Jake said, "Thanks." And they stepped inside where the principal was waiting with Carla, who seemed thoroughly unflustered by the phone call. She and Jake walked away for some privacy. "Hannah's fine," Carla whispered. "They checked on her right away, and she knows nothing."
"The asshole called the school where you work," Jake whispered.
"Watch your language. It's just some nut, Jake."
"I know, but nuts can do stupid things. We've had two calls at the office already.
Do you think it'll blow over?"
"No. There are too many big events just around the corner. The boy's first court appearance, Kofor's funeral, more court appearances, and one day there might be a trial."
"But you're just temporary, right?"
"Right. I'll see Noose tomorrow and tell him what's going on. He can find another lawyer from outside the county. You're okay?"
"I'm fine, Jake. You didn't have to race over here."
"Yes, I did."
He walked out of the building with Officer Lemon, shook hands with him, and thanked him again, and got in his car. Instinctively, he slid back the lid of his console to make sure his automatic pistol was still there. It was, and he cursed it, and shook his head in frustration as he drove away. At least 1,000 times in the past 2 years, he had vowed to put his firearms away and retrieve them only for hunting. But the gun nuts were loose and more rabid than ever. It was safe to assume that in the rural South, every vehicle had a weapon. Old laws had made it necessary to hide them, but newer ones had brought them out into the open. Get a permit these days, and you could hang rifles in your rear window and strap a six-shooter on your hip. Jake despised the idea of keeping guns in his car, his desk at work, his nightstand at home. But once they take shots at you, burn your house, and threaten your family, notions of self-preservation become priority one. Chapter 8. A Mrs. Whitaker and a Mrs. Huff introduced themselves in the third floor waiting room and asked if Jake and Portia would like something to eat. The Good Shepherd Bible Church was in the process of laying siege. The coffee tables and counters were covered with food, and more was on the way. Mrs. Huff explained that the ladies of the church were working shifts now, keeping a watchful eye on Josie Gamble down the hall in that room with the bored deputy sitting outside the door in a rocker. As Mrs. Huff talked, Mrs. Whitaker placed 2 thick slices of triple fudge cake on paper plates and handed one to Portia and one to Jake. Since it was not physically possible to decline the cake, they took small bites with plastic forks as Mrs. Huff went through the results of Josie's latest tests with no respect for privacy. When Jake was finally allowed to speak and told them that he was the court-appointed lawyer for Drew, the ladies were visibly impressed and offered coffee. Jake introduced Portia as his paralegal, but it wasn't clear if they knew what that meant. Mrs. Whitaker said her nephew was a lawyer over in Arkansas, and not to be outdone, Mrs. Huff said her brother had once served on a grand jury. The cake was delicious, and Jake asked for another, smaller slice, and accepted some coffee to wash it down. When he glanced at his watch, Mrs. Whitaker informed him that Josie's door was closed because she was being examined by her doctors.
It wouldn't take long, she assured him, as if she was now well-versed on hospital procedures. Since both ladies seemed hell-bent on talking nonstop, Jake sat down and began asking questions about the Gamble family. Mrs. Whitaker got the jump on her rival and explained that they, mother and children, had been worshiping at Good Shepherd for the past few months. One of the deacons, Mr. Herman Vest, they thought it was, had met Josie where she worked at the car wash in Clanton and struck up a conversation, as he was prone to do. Mr. Vest enjoyed meeting new people and inviting them to church. Mr. Vest, if it was indeed him, had passed along her name to their pastor, Brother Charles, and he had followed up with a home visit, one that reportedly did not go well, because the man of the house, Officer Stuart Cofer, may he rest in peace, had been quite rude to their pastor. Additionally, it was obvious that Josie was living with the man without the benefit of holy matrimony, living in open sin, so that gave them all additional ammo for their prayer lists. Nevertheless, Josie and the kids visited one Sunday morning. The church always took great pride in welcoming visitors. That was one reason its enrollment had almost doubled since Brother Charles had arrived. One big, happy family. Mrs. Huff barged in at this point because she had something special to offer. Kira at the time was only 13 years old, 14 now, and Mrs. Huff taught the young teenage girls in a Sunday school class. Once Mrs. Huff, as well as the rest of the church, came to realize what awful things Josie and the kids had been through, they really took them in. Mrs. Huff had a special interest in Kira, who at first was extremely shy and introverted. But once a month, Mrs. Huff invited the class to her house for pizza, ice cream, and a scary movie sleepover, and she coaxed Kira into joining them. The other girls were terrific. Some knew her from school, but she had a difficult time relaxing at the little party. Portia had put down her cake and was taking notes. When Mrs. Huff paused for a breath, Portia pounced with, "When you say the family had been through some awful things, what do you mean, if you don't mind telling us?" These two women would tell anything, but they did glance at each other as if thinking perhaps they should throttle back. Mrs. Huff said,
"Well, when they were younger, they were separated. Not sure how or why, but I think Josie, and she is a dear, had to go away, maybe got in some trouble, you know. The kids were sent away, something like that."
Mrs. Whitaker added,
"Drew's teacher said the class was doing pen pal letters to boys and girls in orphanages, and Drew said he'd been there once to an orphanage, and he wasn't ashamed to talk about it. Seems like he's more outgoing than his sister."
"Any family around here?" Jake asked. Both ladies shook their heads, no. Mrs. Huff said,
"And I'm not sure about why she took up with that Cofer fellow. He had a bad reputation in the area."
"For what?" Portia asked.
"Well, there were a lot of rumors about the guy down our way. Even though he was a deputy, he had a darker side."
Jake was keen to pursue the dark side when a doctor walked in. The ladies proudly introduced him to the family's lawyer and his paralegal. As in most hospitals, the presence of a lawyer chilled the conversation with the doctor. He assured them the patient was doing fine, still in pain, but getting restless. Once the swelling was under control, they would do the surgery to reset the broken bones in her cheek and jaw. "Can she talk?" Jake asked.
"A little. She struggles, but she wants to talk."
"Could we see her?"
"Sure. Just don't overdo it, okay?"
Jake and Portia hurried from the room as Mrs. Whitaker and Mrs. Huff were pointing the doctor toward the latest casseroles and talking about lunch. It was 10:20. The deputy on hall duty was Lyman Price, probably the oldest member of Ozzie's force, and the one least able to stalk drug dealers and chase down criminals. When he wasn't pushing papers around his desk at the jail, he worked the courtrooms, keeping order in the court.
Killing hours outside a hospital room was another perfect job for old Lyman. He greeted Jake with his usual gruffness, with no hint of an edge because of the Kofor business. Jake knocked on the door as he opened it and smiled at Kira, who was sitting in a chair reading a teen magazine. Josie was on her back, but propped up and alert. Jake introduced himself and Portia and said hello to Kira, who put down the magazine and stood near her mother's feet. Jake said they would just be there for a moment, but he had met with Drew the night before and promised him that he would see his mother and make sure she was okay. She grabbed his hand and squeezed it, and through the gauze mumbled something like,
"How is he?"
"He's okay. We're on our way back to the jail to see him now." Kira had moved closer and was sitting on the edge of the bed. Her eyes were moist, and she wiped her cheeks. And Jake was struck by the fact that she was much taller than her brother, though 2 years younger. Drew could pass for a little boy far away from puberty. Kira was physically mature for her age.
"How long in jail?"
Josie asked. "A long time, Josie. There's no way to get him out for weeks or months. He'll be charged with murder and face a trial, and that'll take a lot of time." Kira leaned forward with a tissue and wiped her mother's cheeks, then wiped her own. There was a long silent pause as a monitor beeped and nurses laughed in the hallway. Jake flinched first and was suddenly eager to leave. He clutched Josie's hand, leaned down and said, "I'll be back. Right now we're going to check on Drew." She tried to nod, but the pain hit and she grimaced. Backing away, Jake handed Kira a business card and whispered, "There's my number." At the door, he turned around for a last glance and saw the two clutching each other in a tight embrace, both crying, both terrified of the unknowns. It was a heartbreaking image that he would never forget. Two little people facing nothing but fear and the wrath of the system, a mother and daughter, who'd done nothing wrong, but were suffering mightily. They had no voice, no one to protect them, no one but Jake. A voice told him that they, along with Drew, would be a part of his life for years to come. The chief prosecutor for the 22nd Judicial District, Polk, Ford, Tyler, Milburn, and Van Buren counties, was the district attorney Lowell Dyer from the even smaller town of Gretna, 40 miles north of Clanton. 3 years earlier, Dyer had challenged the great Rufus Buckley, the three-term DA, who many believed would one day become governor, or at least try. With as much ceremony, publicity, grandstanding, and outright hot-dogging as the state had ever seen, Buckley had prosecuted Carl Lee Haley 5 years earlier and begged the jury for death. Jake convinced them otherwise and handed Buckley his greatest defeat. The voters then gave him another one, and he limped back to his hometown of Smithfield and opened a small office. Jake and virtually every other lawyer in the district had quietly supported Lowell Dyer, who had proven to be a steady hand at a rather dull job. Monday morning was anything but dull. Dyer had taken a call late Sunday night from Judge Noose, and the two had discussed the Kofor case. Ozzie called early Monday morning, and by 9 a.m., Dyer was meeting with his assistant, D.R. Musgrove, to consider their options. From the outset, there was little doubt that the state wanted to push for a capital murder indictment and seek the death penalty. A man of the law had been murdered in his own bed, by his own gun, in cold blood. The killer had confessed and was in custody, and though only 16, he was certainly old enough to know right from wrong and appreciate the nature of his actions. In Dyer's world, the good book taught an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord," or something like that. The exact wording from the Bible was really not that important, because capital punishment was still favored by an overwhelming majority of the population, especially those concerned enough to vote. Polls and public opinion surveys were of no consequence in the rural South, because the issue had long since been settled and public sentiment had not changed. Indeed, when Dyer ran for office, he said several times on the stump that the problem with the gas chamber was that it was not being used enough. This had really pleased the crowds, or at least the white ones. In black churches, he had avoided the issue altogether. The law currently considered murder to be exempt from youth court jurisdiction if the accused was at least 13 years old. A 12-year-old could not be prosecuted in circuit court, the tribunal for all criminal prosecutions. No other state had such a low threshold. In most, the defendant had to be at least 16 to be tried as an adult. Up north, a few states had bumped the age up to 18, but not in the South. Though the gravity of the moment throttled his enthusiasm, Lowell was secretly delighted to have such an important case. In his 3 years, he had not indicted anyone for capital murder, and as a prosecutor who saw himself getting tougher and tougher, he had grown frustrated with such a bland docket. If not for the production and peddling of drugs and the gambling sting run by the feds with local help, he'd have little to do. He had tried a drunk in Polk County for vehicular homicide and put him away for 20 years. He had won 2 bank robberies in Milburn County, same defendant, but the guy had escaped and was still on the lam, probably still robbing banks. Before the Cofer killing, Lowell was spending his time on a joint task force of prosecutors trying to fight the cocaine plague. But with the Cofer killing, Lowell Dyer was suddenly the man in the middle. Unlike his predecessor, Rufus Buckley, who would have already called at least 2 press conferences, Lowell avoided the reporters Monday morning and went about his business. He spoke to Ozzie again, and Noose, and he placed a call to Jake Brigance, but got voicemail. Out of respect, he called Earl Cofer and passed along his sympathies while promising a full measure of justice. He sent his investigator to Clanton to start digging. And he took a call from a pathologist at the state crime lab. The autopsy revealed that Cofer died of a single bullet wound to the head, in through the left temple, out through the right ear. Nothing really remarkable but for the fact that his blood alcohol level was 0.36. 0.36! 3.5 times the state's limit of 0.10 to be legally drunk behind the wheel. Cofer was 6'1" tall and weighed 197 pounds. A man that size and that drunk would have a difficult time doing anything, walking, driving, even breathing. As a small-town lawyer with 15 years' experience, Lowell had never seen or heard of a case involving such a high level of alcohol. He expressed disbelief and asked the pathologist to test the blood again. Lowell would review the autopsy report as soon as he received it, and in due course, he would hand it over to the defense. There would be no way to conceal the fact that Stuart Cofer was blind drunk when he died. No set of facts was ever perfect. Every prosecution, as well as every defense, had its flaws in the proof. But for a deputy to be so raging drunk at 2 a.m. presented a lot of questions, and just hours after landing the case of a lifetime, Lowell Dyer had his first doubt. Jake dropped Portia off at the square and drove to the jail. It was still busier than usual, and he did not want to go inside and face the stairs. But as he parked on the street, he said to himself, "What the hell? You can't defend a cop killer and still be loved by the cops." If they resented Jake for doing his job, a job that no one else wanted but had to be done, then he couldn't worry about it. He entered the front room, where the deputies liked to kill time, gossiping and drinking gallons of coffee,
and said hello to Marshall Prather and Moss Jr. Tatum. They nodded because they had to, but within seconds, Jake realized the battle lines had been drawn. "Is Ozzy in?" he asked Tatum, who shrugged as if he had no clue. Jake kept walking and stopped at Doreen's desk. She was Ozzy's secretary and guarded his door like a Doberman. She also wore a full uniform and carried a gun, though it was no secret she had no law enforcement training and could not legally make an arrest. It was assumed she could use the pistol, but no one had dared to test her.
"He's in a meeting," she said coolly.
"I called half an hour ago, and we agreed to meet at 10:30, Jake said as politely as possible. "It's 10:30.
"I'll buzz him, Jake, but it's been a crazy morning."
"Thank you." Jake walked to a window that overlooked a side street. Beyond it was the first cluster of office buildings that lined the south side of the square. The dome of the courthouse rose above the buildings and the stately oaks that were 200 years old. As he stood there, he was aware that the usual chatter and banter behind him had died down. The deputies were still around, but now so was the defense lawyer.
"Jake," Ozzy called as he opened the door.
Inside his office, the two old friends stood and looked at each other across the big desk. Jake said, "We've already had two threatening phone calls at the office, and someone called the school asking about Carla. Wouldn't leave a name, of course. They never do."
"I know about the call to the school. What am I supposed to do, Jake? Tell people not to call your office?"
"Have you spoken with Earl Cofer?"
"Well, yes, twice. Yesterday at his farm and this morning on the phone. We're trying to work out some details about the funeral, Jake, if that's okay."
"I'm not thinking about the funeral, Ozzy. Could you politely inform Mr. Cofer to inform his people, whoever the hell they are, that they need to back off and leave us alone?"
"So you're certain it's the family?"
"Who else would it be? I'm told they're a bunch of hotheads. They're obviously upset about the killing. Who wouldn't be? Just stop the threats, okay, Ozzy?"
"I think you're upset too, Jake. Maybe you should settle down first. Nobody's been hurt other than Stuart Cofer."
Ozzy took a deep breath and slowly eased into his chair. He nodded, and Jake sat down too. Ozzy said,
"Record the calls and bring them to me. I'll do what I can. You want security again?"
"No, we got tired of that. I'll just shoot them myself."
"Jake, I really don't think you have anything to worry about. The family is upset, but they're not crazy. We'll get through the funeral. Maybe things will settle down. You'll be off the case soon, right?"
"I don't know. I hope so. Have you checked on the boy this morning?"
"I talked to the jailer. Kid's really shut down."
"Has he eaten anything?"
"Some chips, maybe. Drank a Coke."
"Look, Ozzy, I'm no expert, but I think the kid is traumatized and needs help. He could be in the middle of some type of breakdown for all we know."
"Forgive me, Jake, but I'm not feeling the sympathy."
"I get that. I'll see Noose in the morning before the civil docket, and I plan to ask him to send the kid to Whitfield for tests. I need your help."
"My help?"
"Yes. Noose admires you, and if you agree that the kid needs to see a professional, then he might go along. The kid is in your custody, and you know more about his condition than anyone else right now. Bring the jailer over, and we'll meet with Noose in his chambers. Off the record. You won't have to testify or anything. The rules are different for minors." Ozzy gave a sarcastic laugh and looked away.
"Let me get this straight. This kid, regardless of his age, murdered my deputy, whose memorial service or funeral or whatever you white folks call these events has not yet been planned, and here I am with the defense lawyer who's asking me to help out with the defense. Right, Jake?"
"I'm asking you to do what's right here, Ozzy. That's all."
"The answer is no. I haven't even seen the kid since they brought him in. You're pushing too hard, Jake. Back off."
Ozzy was glaring across the desk when he gave the warning. and Jake got the message. He got to his feet and said, "Okay, I'd like to see my client." He took him a can of Mountain Dew and a package of peanuts, and after a few minutes managed to coax Drew from under the covers. He sat on the edge of his bed and opened the drink. "I saw your mother this morning," Jake said. "She's doing great. Kira is with her at the hospital, and there are some folks from the church taking care of him." Drew's eyes never left his feet as he nodded. His blonde hair was stringy, matted, dirty, and his entire body needed a good scrubbing. They had yet to dress him in the standard orange jail jumpsuit, which would be an improvement over the cheap and wrinkled clothes he wore. He kept nodding and asked,
"What church?"
"I believe it's called the Good Shepherd Bible Church. The pastor is a guy named Charles McGarry. You know him?"
"I think so. Stu didn't want us to go to church. Is he really dead?"
"He's dead, Drew."
"And I shot him?"
"Sure looks that way. You don't remember?"
"Sometimes I do. Sometimes I don't. Sometimes I think I'm dreaming, you know? Like right now. Are you really here talking to me? What's your name?"
"Jake. We met last night when I stopped by. Do you remember that?" A long silence followed. He took a sip and then tried to open the peanuts. When he couldn't, Jake gently took the package, tore the top, and gave it back. Jake said, "This is not a dream, Drew. I'm your lawyer. I've met your mother and sister, and so now I represent the family. It's important for you to trust me and talk to me."
"About what?"
"About what? Let's talk about the house where you live with Kira and your mother and Stuart Kofer. How long have you lived there?" More silence as he stared at the floor, as if he'd heard nothing Jake said. "How long, Drew? How long did you live with Stuart Kofer?"
"I don't remember. Is he really dead?"
"Yes." The can slipped from his hand and hit the floor with foam splashing near Jake's feet. It rolled a bit, then stopped, but continued leaking the soda. Drew did not react to the dropped can, and Jake tried his best to ignore it too as the puddle inched closer to his shoes. Drew closed his eyes and began to make a low humming sound, a soft, painful groan that came from somewhere deep within. His lips began moving slightly, as if he was mumbling to himself. After a moment, Jake almost said something to interrupt him, but decided to wait. Drew could have been a monk in a deep trance-like meditation, or a mental patient, drifting away again into the darkness. But Drew was a wounded child in need of help that Jake was unqualified to give. Chapter 9. By noon Monday, Ozzy was fed up with the crowds and noise, the off-duty guys hanging around to gather or spread the latest gossip, the retired cops just wanting to be part of the brotherhood, the useless reserves taking up space, the reporters, the nosy old ladies from town stopping by with brownies and donuts as if massive quantities of sugar would help in some way, the curious, with no discernible reason for being there, the politicians, hoping their presence would remind voters that they believed in law and order, and friends of the Kofers, who thought they were helping the situation by offering their support for the good guys and supporting the boys in blue. Ozzy ordered everyone who wasn't on duty out of the building. For over 30 hours, he had worked hard at maintaining the facade of a pro untouched by the tragedy, but fatigue was settling in. He had barked at Doreen, who barked back,
The tension was palpable. He gathered his A-team in his office and politely asked Doreen to guard the door and hold all calls. Moss Jr. Tatum, Marshall Prather, and Willie Hastings. None were in uniform, nor was Ozzie. He passed around sheets of paper and asked them all to take a look. After enough time, he said,
.36. Can any of you remember catching a drunk driver who registered .36?
The three veterans had seen it all, or thought so. Prather said,
I've had a couple of threes, but nothing higher. Not that I can remember.
Moss Jr. shook his head in disbelief and said,
not here.
Hastings said,
Butch Vango's boy was .35. I think that's a record for Ford County.
And he died, Prather said.
Next day at the hospital. I didn't bring him in, so I didn't do the test.
There was no test, Prather said. He wasn't driving. They found him lying in the middle of Craft Road one morning. Called it alcohol poisoning.
Okay, okay, Ozzie said. Point is, our fallen brother was saturated with enough booze to kill most men. Point is, Kofa had a problem. Point is, Kofa was out of control, and we didn't know the extent of it, did we?
Prather said, we talked about this yesterday, Ozzie. You're trying to blame us for not ratting out a fellow officer.
I am not, but I smell a cover-up. There were at least 2 incident reports filed after Kofa's girlfriend called when he slapped her around. I never saw them, and now I can't find them. We've looked all morning.
Ozzie was the sheriff, elected and reelected by the people, and the only person in the room who was required to face the voters every 4 years. The other 3 were his top deputies and owed him their paychecks and careers. They understood the relationships, the issues, the politics. It was imperative that they protect him as much as possible. They weren't sure if Ozzie had actually seen the memos, and they weren't sure how much he knew, but at the moment, they were on board with whatever image he wanted to project. Ozzie continued,
Pirtle and McCarver filed one about a month ago, after she called the dispatcher late one night. Then she refused to press charges, so nothing happened. They swear they filed the report, but it ain't here. Turns out that 4 months ago, the girlfriend called the dispatcher, same crap. Kofa came home drunk, slapped her around. Officer Swayze made the call, but she wouldn't press charges. He filed the report, now it's gone. I never saw it. Never saw either one. Here's the problem, boys. Jake stopped by an hour ago. He's been appointed by Noose, and he claims he doesn't want the case. Says Noose will find somebody else as soon as possible. We can't be sure of that, and it's out of our control. For now, Jake is the lawyer, and it'll take him about 5 minutes to sniff out missing paperwork. Not now, but down the road, if this thing goes to trial. I know Jake well. Hell, we all know him, and he'll be a step ahead of us.
Why would Jake get involved? Prather asked.
As I said, because Noose appointed him. The kid has to have a lawyer, and evidently, no one else would take it.
I thought we had a public defender, Hastings said. I like Jake, and I don't want him on the other side.
Willie Hastings was a cousin to Gwen Haley, mother of Tanya, wife of Carl Lee, and in their world, Jake Brigance walked on water.
Our public defender is a greenhorn who's yet to handle a serious case. I've heard that Noose doesn't like him. Look, guys, Omar Noose is the circuit judge and has been for a long time. Love him or hate him, but he rules the system. He can make or break a lawyer, and he's quite fond of Jake. Jake couldn't say no.
But I thought Jake was just doing the preliminary stuff until they brought in somebody else, Prather asked.
Who knows? A lot can happen, and it's still early. They may have trouble finding somebody else. Also, Jake's an ambitious lawyer who likes the attention. Keep in mind, he was hired and trained by Lucian Wilbanks, a radical in his day, who would defend anyone.
I can't believe it, Tatum said. Jake did a land deal for my uncle last year.
Ozzie said. He said they're already getting phone calls, threats. I'm going to ride out again and talk to Earl Kofer, pay my respects and such, talk about the burial and make sure those folks are under control.
The Kofers are okay, Prather said. I know some of them, and they're just in shock right now.
Aren't we all? Asked Ozzie. He closed the file, took a deep breath, and looked at his three deputies. He settled on Prather and finally asked, Okay, let's hear it.
Marshall tossed his sheet of paper on the desk and lit a cigarette. He walked to a window, cracked it for ventilation, and leaned against the wall.
I talked to my cousin. He wasn't out with Kofer Saturday night. He called around and got the scoop. Seems there was a card game at Dog Hickman's cabin near the lake. Poker, low stakes, not a high-dollar crowd. But an unnamed player showed up with some shine, peach-flavored, fresh from the still. And they got into it. Everybody got wasted. Three of them passed out and stayed there. They don't remember much. Kofer decided it would be smart to drive home. Somehow he made it.
Ozzie interrupted with, Sounds like Gary Garva's still.
Prather took a drag and stared at the sheriff.
I didn't ask for names, Ozzie. And none were offered, except for Kofer and Dog Hickman. Kofer's dead, and the other four are kind of scared right now.
Scared of what?
I don't know. Maybe they feel some responsibility. They were gambling and hitting the moonshine, and now their buddy is dead.
They must be stupid. I didn't say they weren't. If we start raiding dice and poker games, we'll have to build a new jail. Get me the names, okay? And assure them that they will not be charged.
I'll try.
Get their names, Marshal. Because you can bet that Harry Rex Vonnegut will have the names by tomorrow, and Jake will get to them first.
Moss Jr. said,
They've done nothing wrong. What's the big deal? The only crime here is murder, and we got the killer, right?
Nothing is that simple, Ozzie said. If this thing goes to trial, you can bet your ass the defense lawyer, whoever it is, will make hay out of Kofa's bad behavior that led to the shooting.
They can't do that, Prather said. He's dead.
And why is he dead? Is he dead because he came home drunk and fell asleep and this stupid kid thought it would be fun to blow his brains out? No. Is he dead because his girlfriend wanted his money? No, Marshall. He's dead because he had the bad habit of getting bombed and punching her around and her boy tried to protect her. This will be an ugly trial, boys. So just get ready for it. That's why it's imperative now that we know everything that happened. Start with Dog Hickman. Who can talk to him?
Swayze knows him,
Willie said. Okay, get Swayze to run him down as soon as possible. And make sure these clowns know we're not after them.
Got it, boss.
With Carla teaching school and spending many of her evenings preparing lesson plans and grading papers and trying to monitor Hannah's homework, there was little time for the kitchen. The three ate dinner together most evenings at exactly 7. Jake occasionally stayed at the office until late or was out of town, but the life of a small-time practitioner did not require much time on the road. Dinner was always something quick and as healthy as possible. A lot of chicken and vegetables, baked fish, few breads or grains, and they avoided red meat and added sugar. Afterward, they hustled to clear the table and tidy up the kitchen and get on with more pleasant matters like television, reading, or playing games once Hannah had finished her homework. On perfect nights, Jake and Carla enjoyed walks through the neighborhood, short little excursions with the doors locked and Hannah safe in her room. She refused to walk with them because being all alone in the house was such a cool move for a big girl. She would settle in with Mully the Mutt and read a book as the house became quiet and still. Her parents were never more than 10 minutes away. After one of the longest Mondays in recent memory, Jake and Carla locked the doors and walked to the edge of the street where they paused by the dogwoods and enjoyed the aroma. Their home, known as the Hocut House, was one of 20 on a shady old street 8 blocks from the Clanton Square. Most of the homes were owned by elderly pensioners who struggled to keep up with the ever-increasing maintenance, but a few had been reclaimed by younger families. 2 doors down was a young doctor from Pakistan, who at first had not been well received because no one could pronounce his name and his skin was darker. But after 3 years and thousands of consultations, he knew more secrets than anyone in town and was widely admired. Across the street from him and his pleasant wife lived a young couple with 5 children and no jobs. He claimed to run the family timber business his grandfather started and handed down, but he seldom left the country club. She played golf and bridge and spent most of her time supervising the staff that was raising her brood. Besides those 2 homes, though, and the Hocut House, the rest of the street was dark as the older folks turned in early. Carla suddenly stopped, pulled on Jake's hand, and said,
"Hannah's alone."
"So?"
"You think she's safe?"
"Of course she's safe." Nonetheless, they instinctively turned around. After a few steps, Carla said,
"I can't do this again, Jake. We've just settled into a normal routine, and I really don't want to start worrying again."
"There's nothing to worry about."
"Oh, really?"
"Okay, yes, there's something to worry about, but the threat level is low. A few strange phone calls here and there, all made by cowards who wouldn't give their names and hid behind payphones."
"I think I've heard this before, right before they burned down our house."
They walked a few steps, still holding hands.
"Can you get rid of the case?"
she asked. "I just got it yesterday."
"I know. I remember. And you see Judge Noose in the morning?"
"Bright and early, for motions in Smallwood."
"Will you talk about this case?"
"I'm sure we will. It's the only case that's being discussed anyway. Drew needs help right now, or at least he needs to be seen by a professional. If I get the chance, I'll ask Noose about it. And if by chance he's found another lawyer, then I'm sure he'll tell me."
"But that's unlikely."
"Yes, it's unlikely this soon. I'll do the preliminary stuff, make sure the kid's rights are protected, try to get him some help and so on. And then in a few weeks, I'll push Noose hard to find a replacement."
"Promise?"
"Yes, I promise. You doubt me?"
"Sort of, yes."
"Why?"
"Because you care, Jake. And I already get the sense that you're worried about this kid and his family, and you want to protect them. And if Judge Noose has a difficult time finding another lawyer, it'll be easy for him to just lean on you again. You'll be in place. The family will trust you. And be honest, Jake, you enjoy being in the center of the ring."
They turned into their narrow driveway and admired their lovely home, all safe and quiet. Jake said, "I thought you wanted me to represent the kid."
"I thought so too, but that was before we started getting phone calls."
"They're just phone calls, Carla. Nothing counts until they start shooting."
"Well, that makes me feel better."
According to Earl's lawyer, the property was owned solely by Stuart, having been passed down through probate, courtesy of his grandfather who died 12 years earlier. The 2 ex-wives were long gone, and their names had never been on the deed. Stuart fathered no known children. He died without a will, and under Mississippi law, the property would be inherited by his parents, Earl and Janet, and his younger siblings in equal shares. After dinner Monday night, Earl and his 2 surviving sons, Barry and Cecil, drove to the house for the first look around since it was released by the state investigators that afternoon. It was not a visit they wanted to make. but it had to be done. When Earl parked behind Stuart's pickup and turned off the headlights, they sat and stared at the dark house, a place they had known forever. Barry and Cecil asked if they could remain in the car. Earl said no. It was important for them to see where he died. In the rear seat, Barry tried to muffle his sobs. Finally, they got out and walked to the front door, which was not locked. Earl braced himself and entered the bedroom first. The mattress had been stripped of its sheets and blankets, and a large, hideous stain of dried blood dominated the center of it. Earl backed into the only chair in the room and covered his eyes. Barry and Cecil stood in the door and gawked at the gruesome spot where their brother had breathed his last. There were specks of blood on the wall above the headboard and 100 tiny divots where the technicians had removed matter for whatever was to be done with it later. The room smelled of death and evil, and a sharp, pungent odor, not unlike that of roadkill, grew heavier the more they inhaled. Ozzy said they could burn the mattress. They dragged it through the kitchen and across the small wooden deck to a spot in the backyard. They did the same with the headboard, frame, box springs, and pillows. No one would ever again sleep on Stuart's bed. In a small closet in the hall, they found Josie's clothes and shoes, and after taking stock of her belongings, Earl said, "Let's burn them too." In a dresser, they found her undergarments, pajamas, socks, and so on. And in the bathroom, they found her hairdryer and toiletries. Her purse was on a kitchen counter by the phone, and beside it was a set of car keys. Cecil left the keys and did not look inside the purse, but tossed it onto the mattress with the rest of her things. Earl poured lighter fluid and lit a match. They watched the fire grow quickly and took a step back.
"Get the kids' stuff, too," he said to Cecil and Barry. "They ain't coming back here."
They raced upstairs to the boys' room and grabbed everything that might burn. Bed linens, clothing, shoes, books, a cheap CD player, banners on the wall. Barry cleaned out the girls' room. She had a few more items than her brother, including some stuffed bears and other animals. In her closet, he found a box of old dolls and other toys, which he hauled downstairs and outside and happily tossed on the roaring fire. They inched away from it and, mesmerized, watched it grow until it began to die out. Barry asked his father,
"What about her car?"
Earl sneered at the old Mazda parked beside the house and for a moment thought about torching it too. But Barry said,
"I think she owes money on it."
"Better leave it alone," Earl said.
They had discussed gathering Stuart's personal effects, his guns and clothing and such, but Earl decided they could do it later. The house had been in the family for a long time and was secure. He would change the locks tomorrow and drive over to check on it each day, and he would pass along the word through Ozzy that there was no reason for that woman or her kids or any of her friends to ever set foot on Cofer property again. Ozzy could deal with her car. Dog Hickman ran the only motorcycle shop in town and sold new and used bikes. Though he was familiar with illegal activities, he had been smart enough to avoid getting caught and had no record other than an old drunk driving conviction. The police knew him well, but since he didn't bother people, he was left alone. Dog's vices were primarily gambling, bootlegging, and dealing in pot. Mick Swayze had traded several motorcycles with Dog and knew him well. He stopped by the shop after dark on Monday, and after assuring him that he was off duty, took a beer. Mick got right to the point and promised Dog that Ozzy was not looking for people to accuse. He just wanted to know what happened on Saturday night.
"I'm not worried about Ozzy," Dog said confidently.
They were outside leaning on his Mustang smoking cigarettes.
"I've done nothing wrong."
I mean, I wish I hadn't drunk so much, so maybe I could have stopped Stu before he got lit, you know? I should have stopped him, but I didn't do anything wrong.
We know that, Swayze said. And we know there were five of you at your cabin passing around a jug. Who were the other three?
I ain't snitching.
How can you snitch, dog, if there's no crime?
If there's no crime, what are you doing here asking questions?
Ozzy wants to know, that's all. Kofor was one of us, and Ozzy liked him a lot. We all liked Stuart. Good cop, great guy. He was also drunk as a skunk, dog. 0.36.
Dog shook his head in disbelief at this news and spat on the ground.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. When I woke up yesterday morning, my head felt like it was 0.55. I stayed in bed all day and barely got out this morning. Crazy shit, man.
What was it?
Fresh batch from Gary Garver, peach flavored.
That's three. Who were the other two?
This is confidential, right? You ain't telling nobody.
Got it.
Calvin Marr and Wayne Agner. We started off with a case of beer, just playing poker in my cabin. No big plans, really. Then Gary showed up with two quarts of his good stuff. We all got hammered. I mean, blacked out. First time in a long time, and it was bad enough to make me think about quitting.
What time did Kofor leave?
Don't know. I wasn't awake when he left.
Who was awake?
Don't know, Mick, I swear. I think we all passed out and things went black. I don't remember much. At some point in the night, have no idea when, Stu and Gary left the cabin. When I woke up late Sunday, Calvin and Wayne were still there in rough shape. We got up, tried to stir around, drank a couple of beers to kill the pain. Then the phone rang and my brother told me Stu was dead. Shot in the head by some kid. Hell, he was just there, right there at the card table, shuffling cards and sipping peach whiskey from a coffee cup.
You been hanging out with Stu?
I don't know. What kind of question is that?
A simple one.
Not as much as a year ago. He was losing control, Mick, you know. We'd play poker once a month, usually at the cabin, and you could always count on Stu to overdo things, drink too much. Who am I, right? But there was talk about Stu. Some of his friends were concerned. Hell, we all drink too much, but sometimes it's the drunks who see what's really going on. We figured Ozzy knew about it and turned a blind eye.
I don't think so. Stu showed up for work every day and did his job. He was one of Ozzy's favorites.
Mine too. Everybody likes Stu.
Will you talk to Ozzy?
Well, I don't want to.
No rush, but he'd just like to have a chat. Maybe after the funeral.
Like I got a choice?
Not really.
Chapter 10. As with most hot courthouse rumors, the source would never be known. Did it spring to life behind a hint of truth, or was it someone's idea of a joke down in the office of land records on the first floor? Did a bored lawyer create the fiction with one eye on the clock to see how soon the story would make the rounds and find its way back to him? Since the courthouse, indeed the entire town, was still buzzing with the details of the murder, it was not too far-fetched to believe that someone with a bit of authority, perhaps a deputy or a bailiff, might have said something like, "Yep, we're bringing the boy over today." At any rate, early Tuesday morning, half the county knew for a fact that the kid who killed Stuart Kofor would appear in court for the first time. And for good measure, the rumor was soon amended to include the irresistible fact that he would probably be released. Something to do with his age. On a routine day, the civil docket attracted only a few lawyers who had motions pending, never a crowd of spectators. But on Tuesday, the gallery was half full, as dozens gathered in the main courtroom to witness this horrendous miscarriage of justice. The clerks checked and rechecked the docket to see if they had missed something. Judge Noose was not expected until almost 10, when the first motion hearing was supposed to start. When Jake ambled in at 9:30, he at first thought he had somehow chosen the wrong date. He whispered to a clerk and was told about the rumor. "That's odd," he whispered back, as he scanned the hard faces staring at him. "Seems like I'd know it if my client was coming to court."
"That's usually the way we do things," she whispered back.
Harry Rex arrived and began insulting an insurance lawyer. Others milled about with eyes on the crowd and wondering what was the attraction. Bailiffs and deputies huddled to one side, aware of the rumor but unaware of any orders to bring the defendant over from the jail. Lowell Dyer entered through a side door and greeted Jake. They agreed to have a word with Noose as soon as possible. At 10, His Honor called them back to his chambers and offered them coffee as he lined up his second round of daily medications. His robe was hanging on the door and his jacket was draped over a chair.
"How's the defendant?" he asked.
Noose had always been gaunt, with a long, lanky frame and a sloping nose that was often redder than the rest of his pale skin. He had never looked that healthy, and to watch him knock back an impressive collection of pills made the lawyers wonder just how sick he might be. But they didn't dare ask what was ailing him. Jake poured 2 cups of coffee into paper cups, and he and Lowell sat across from the judge. Jake replied, "Well, Judge, the kid is not doing too well. I saw him this morning for the 3rd straight day, and he's shutting down. I think he's traumatized and having some sort of breakdown. Can we get him evaluated and perhaps treated? This might be a sick little boy."
"Boy," Lowell asked, "try telling that to the Kofas." "He's 16, Jake," Judge Noose said, "hardly a boy."
"Wait till you meet him."
"Evaluated where?" Lowell asked.
"Well, I'd prefer that the pros do it, down at the state hospital."
"Lowell, the state objects, as for right now, anyway."
"I'm not sure you have the right to object, Lowell," Jake said.
"There's no case yet. Shouldn't you wait until you get the indictment?" "I suppose."
"Here's the problem," Jake said. "The kid needs help right now. Today, this very moment. He's suffering from some type of trauma, and he's not improving sitting over there in the jail. He needs to be seen by a doctor, a psychiatrist, someone a lot smarter than we are. If that doesn't happen, then he may continue to deteriorate. At times, he refuses to talk to me. He can't remember from one day to the next. He's not eating. He's having crazy dreams and hallucinating. At times, he just sits and stares and makes this weird humming noise like he's lost his mind. Don't you want a healthy defendant, Lowell? If the boy's crazy as a loon, you can't put him on trial. There's no harm in at least getting someone, some doctor, to take a look." Lowell looked at Noose, who was chewing a pill that must have been bitter.
Noose said, "Crime, suspect, arrest, jail. Looks to me like the defendant needs a first appearance."
"We'll waive it," Jake said. "There's nothing to be gained by hauling the kid over in a police car and dragging him into a courtroom. He simply can't handle that right now. I'm being honest here, Judge. I don't think the kid knows what's happening around him."
Lowell smiled and shook his head as if he had doubts.
"Sounds to me like you're already laying the groundwork for an insanity plea, Jake."
"I am not, because Judge Noose here has promised me that he'll find another lawyer to handle the trial, if there is a trial."
"Oh, there will be a trial, Jake. I can promise that," Lowell said. "You can't kill a man in cold blood and walk away."
"Nobody's walking away here, Lowell. I'm just worried about this kid. He's detached from reality. What's the harm in having him evaluated?"
Noose had finished with his meds and was choking them down with a glass of water. He looked at Jake and asked, "Who would do it?" "State Health has a regional office in Oxford. Maybe we can send him over there to be examined."
"Can they send someone over here?"
Noose asked.
"I really don't like the idea of the defendant leaving jail so soon."
"Agreed," Lowell said. "They haven't had the funeral yet. I'm not sure the kid would be safe outside the jail."
"Fine," Jake said. "I don't care how we do it."
Noose raised his hands and called for order.
"Let's agree on a plan here, fellas. I assume, Mr. Dyer, that you plan to seek an indictment for capital murder. Is this correct?"
"Well, Judge, it's still a bit early, but yes, that's how I'm leaning as of today. It appears as if the facts call for such an indictment."